Okay, can we have the screen up? That would be good. Good, let's hope the technology works. You know how fun technology is. Ola and I are going to do a bit of a talk about some of the work that we're both involved in. There's a lot more we could say than we will have time to say. That's no surprise. So I'm just going to start by telling you about a couple of ways you can explore some of this further. A lot of the ideas that we're going to skate over are in this book of mine. It's called Mission-Shaped Evangelism because it's about reimagining evangelism, particularly in Western nations, as cross-cultural mission. So a lot of the ideas about the way culture is, the early church and the way it engaged with its culture, and how we might respond are in here. So we're going to give you a little bit of that. But I also really want to encourage you to write this website address down, inthemasterslight.net. This is Ola's organization. There's a lot of good stories and resources and things up on there that'll explain more about the ministries we're involved in. I want to start by talking a little bit about some of the cultural context. We're very much in the context of 2.0 that Philip Jenkins was 2.1 that Philip Jenkins was telling us about this morning. That kind of society where the traditional Christian Europe breaks down and what replaces it. And very much the mission context we're working with is to do with what is coming in, if you like, on the back of the breakdown of that traditional culture. One of the ways of talking about it could be about the differences between modernity and postmodernity. There's a question mark, the sociologists argue about it. Social science is part of my background, but we won't go fully into that. But just some pointers. Very much the printing press was a key invention of the modern world. And it was a key invention, actually, for the Reformation and the spread of Christianity in Europe, because we used the invention of the printing press to print Bibles to enable those to get into people's hands. Well, in many ways, I think the invention of the internet is as significant in our age as the invention of the printing press was in that time previous. And so the challenge is, how do we respond to this new situation where words and text in books are not privileged anymore, and people tend to go, they Google bits of information, and you get a snapshot here and a snapshot there. How do we respond to that kind of a world? Then also, modernity was very much the culture of experts, people who supposedly had all the knowledge and the answers on things. And in some ways, Christian evangelists, Christian pastors, were religious experts. They were people you could trust to have answers on spiritual questions. Perhaps the ultimate modern expert is the scientist, and to imagine the way experts are now often seen, I want you to imagine that you turn on the TV, there's a news program, and a scientist comes on to tell you it's perfectly safe to eat a certain food product. What do you think? You probably think someone is paying the scientist to say this to me, probably for the very reason that the food product is not safe. Well, the unfortunate reality is that people treat Christian ministers, evangelists, and pastors with exactly the same cynicism. They do not assume, when we're sharing our faith with them, that we are trying to help them and benefit them. They suspect we have another motive, probably to get people into our churches to pay for the roof program or keep the pastor's salary going. How do we overcome that kind of a barrier? People are very much moving more to a world in which they seek beliefs inside themselves, in their own meditation, in their own hearts, rather than from religious traditions. How do we cope with that kind of a change? Then also modernity very much about rationalism, the way we think, the way we argue, scientific experimentation. And a lot of the way we've learned to share our faith is based on that kind of world, arguing for the rationality and the truth of the Christian faith. We now live in a world where Descartes saying cogito ergo sum, this only works in English, but I'll explain it to you later, could be translated as Tesco ergo sum, though actually Tesco's is now growing right across Europe. It's a big English supermarket. In a sense, we've replaced the world of the rational scientific experiment with the world of consumer shopping, and our identities are something we purchase. And underlying all of this is a very strong logic of consumerism. And that consumerism affects the way people approach spirituality as much as it does anything else. So one of the big things that's been going on in Europe about spirituality is that it's being turned into a consumer product rather than a lifestyle or a person or a god to follow. And one of the other things that's really working with this is a big change in the way people understand and construct truth, which is also very important. We've been hearing a lot about the importance of truth and history. For modern people, truth was very much about facts. Facts are universally true. If it's true, it is true. You demonstrate it by rational argument and scientific experiment. For postmodern people, truth is primarily about experience. It's what happened to me. It's what happened to my friend. It's what happened to the person I saw on the TV program last night. And because my experience and your experience may be different, it makes perfect sense to a postmodern person to say, that may be true for you, but it isn't true for me. And if you're a modern person, that's a nonsense statement. It either is true or it isn't true. So we start to live in a world where people construct their own belief systems out of all sorts of bits of stuff that make sense to them, rather than purchase into, we say buy into, don't we? That shows how the way it works, into a religion that offers answers and a way forward. This is about church attendance in the UK. You'd see similar things in most countries with a Christian tradition. And the way this works is that bottom line was how many people of each age group attended church monthly in the year 2005. The top blue line was for the same ages in the population, how many of them were connected to church when they were under 16. And we were hearing from Dave Roberts, weren't we, about the way the Sunday school movement in Britain meant that so many people had contact with the church. If you go back to people at the start of the 20th century in Britain, about 80% of our children were regularly in church or Sunday school. It's now fallen to about 12%. And the big story, if you like, in many Western Christian nations has been the collapse of the heritage of children in the church and all the consequences we were hearing about that. So maybe you might have about 9% in church. A group here I call D Church. Now, these are people raised in faith who no longer go. But the largest group, particularly amongst the young, are people who have no rootedness in the Christian tradition whatsoever. Now, this is a statistic that Dave Roberts also gave you earlier. It comes from a study of adults who came to faith in Britain. And over 3/4 of them had a Christian background. Now, the other interesting thing is that on the whole, those people responded to the evangelistic events we're used to seeing. Evangelistic preaching, evangelistic suppers, those kind of things. Those people responded to them. The less than 1/4 who didn't have a Christian background, on the whole, never responded to the evangelism we did. They came over time through personal friendships with Christians. Now, you only have to look at that graph to realize if we are reliant on winning for Christ people on the basis of their Christian background, the church is in terminal decline. We have to learn how to share the Christian faith with people who have no Christian background. And this is the challenge we face. I want to show you how this kind of pattern has worked in Britain. You look at those born in the 20s and 30s. A lot of them were raised in church. Not so many go now. But you notice most of them will still say they're Christian. They still have some belief in God. They want children to be raised in the faith. Now, the thing about this belief in God thing, when they do surveys, they tend to ask you a question. Do you believe in God, a life force, or a higher power? And then they split between the two answers. And to give you an idea of the life force and higher power, people who tick that often have a vision of God which is more like the force in Star Wars than it is the God of the Christian and Judaic tradition. So that's an interesting column to watch as we go through time. Now, these people are often easier to win back to faith. Now, you look at the next generation. In Britain, those born in the 40s and 50s who grew up in the 1960s are the pivot generation where we move from a majority raised in church to a majority not raised in church. And look what's happening here to their belief that children should be raised in God. That's starting to fall away. They're starting to come up with the attitude, no, that's for them to choose when they get older. Consumer logic coming in. When you get to the next generation, you really start to see the pattern unfold. Those born in the 60s and the 70s. Very few now raised in church, even less going. But you notice what's falling away there is the Christian affiliation and the desire to see children raised with a belief in God. What remains high is a belief that there is something out there. But it's almost entirely now that vague life force rather than the God you can know personally. Now, this is what I think in a few years' time, if we do it on the next generation, from what we know so far, it will look like. So we have a situation growing up in a country like Britain, and I'm going to show you that it's similar in many other European countries, where people's connection to the Christian heritage is dying out. They have no knowledge of Christianity, but they remain believing in something there. What is not happening across Europe is a massive growth in secular atheism. People are not becoming believers in nothing. They're just not sure what they believe in. But they think there is something out there. Now, these are some European figures looking on from the European Values Survey. So Belgium, looking at the change from 81 to 89. Or France, one of the countries with the most atheists, but it's still only about 20%. Or Spain. But you see, the trend is the same in all the countries. That shift towards the life force as opposed to the personal God. These are people who said they were religious in 1999. You see, according to their age groups, again, what you see is the older people tend to be more religious, the younger less religious. And what's more is the younger people don't get more religious over time, they get even less religious over time. So we have a whole fading away of the Christian tradition. These are some beliefs in the UK in the year 2005. When you get to something like belief in restless spirits, ghosts and things like that, notice the difference between the over 65s and the under 65s. This is what I refer to as the 1960s effect. And it shows how from the 1960s, and you know, you may remember the Beatles going off to the Maharishi Yogi and all this kind of stuff, a lot of other spiritualities and ideas started coming in into the Western culture. Similar for belief in karma. Experience of fortune-telling, tarot, astrology, psychics, and palmists. Now, it's not that the 45% of 18 to 24-year-olds have had this experience all base their life on fortune-telling. They don't. But they're interested in it. They're exploring this. They're not exploring Christianity. And that's the challenge that we face. I often talk about new spiritualities coming from both a New Age and a pagan background. And I could say a lot more about this, but just some notes. The New Age end very much, and these are kind of sliding scale on the spectrum. The New Age end very influenced by Eastern thought, Hinduism, Buddhism, things like that. Very good to personal therapy, finding God within you, transcending the body. And it's very strongly consumer orientated, which is one of the reasons it's so good at infiltrating our consumer society. It turns out in these consumer products that people want to buy in a way that Christianity doesn't. The pagan end is a more European end, very much orientated to community, the planet, ecology, creation, goddess spirituality. One of the biggest recruiting things for paganism is women leaving Christianity because they perceive Christianity as a male patriarchal religion, and they're looking for a religion that affirms women and their ministry. And it often can be consumer protest. A lot of the people who go out and protest against G20 summits are pagans. Now, just an aside, in Eastern Europe, there is a particularly interesting rise in paganism at the moment after the collapse of the communist bloc. And this is partly as almost a nationalistic thing of people saying, the Russians imposed Christianity on us. We now want our indigenous religion, and it's paganism. So this takes different forms in different places. I think it looks a bit like this. It's like a triangle. And whilst you've got people who are into these new spiritualities and people who are solidly religious and people who are committed atheists, this is Australian, but the shape would be right for Europe, even if the actual numbers wouldn't be. Most people are just floating in the middle. But those people floating in the middle, on the whole, would say things like, I believe there's truth in every religion, but no one religion is true. They would say, I believe there is some kind of a God, but I'm not sure what it's like. They would be very open to astrology and to palmistry and all those kind of things, even if they don't base their life on them. Now, this is the demography of a lot of the people we're trying to reach in Europe with the Christian faith. And how do we do this? I'm just going to flick through this one, actually, because I don't think we're going to have time. But I am going to ask the question, what are these people experiencing? Because I think it's a vital question. You have a whole load of people out there exploring spirituality with no religious language and no religious background with which to interpret it. Now, as I sit and talk with these people and they talk about their experiences to me, I am fairly convinced that a lot of them are experiencing God, but they don't know that. It's rather like Paul in Athens, and I'm going to say a bit more about that in a moment. We're explaining to them the unknown God, which they are out there trying to connect with, and trying to show them that actually the God we know in Jesus Christ is the one who can make sense of their lives and their experiences and lead them forward. When I went to theological college, I was taught two subjects. One was mission, which is what you did abroad, and that was cross-cultural, and the other was evangelism, and that's what you did at home. The reality is we are now cross-cultural evangelists in our own countries, trying to reach people of very different culture and background to the one we've been in. And I think we can learn from Paul in doing this. You note that if you look at his sermons to Jews, who he shared his faith background with, you would see a very common pattern where he expounds the Jewish scriptures to prove that Jesus is the Messiah. But when he preaches to Greeks, he can't do that. They do not know those scriptures. They carry no knowledge for them. But he finds things within their culture and their exploration that he can use to tell them the message of Jesus Christ. So in Athens, he actually quotes poetry in praise of Zeus, but significantly exploring the idea that he may be the only God, and uses this to say, I'm going to tell you about the only God. And you'll find in the early church all sorts of evangelistic programs that use the ideas of the culture around and use them as the springboard to explain about how Christ was the answer in this. I'm going to flip through this, but the ideas are available. I wonder if Paul might say to us, if he was alive today, to the spiritual seekers, I became like a spiritual seeker. To the New Agers, I became like a New Ager. To the pagans, I became like a pagan. I have become all things to all people, that by any means I may win some. Now, this is the kind of context that Ola and I often work in, at fairs with people offering all sorts of spiritualities. And I'm now going to hand over to Ola, who's going to talk a bit about the work of In the Master's Light in this context.
I've been involved in a ministry towards adherents of new religious movements, New Age, and new spiritualities of life since the middle of the 1970s. My first encounters were marked by suspicion and opposition. I suspected the new religions and new spiritualities of being inspired from the devil, and their practices I deemed unhealthy and spiritually and psychologically dangerous. In my early encounters, I mainly met people who suffered from psychological disorder and influence from demons, and my main ministry was pastoral, it was caring for the victims of cults, and it was apologetical heresy hunting. But since the beginning of my ministry, I've, however, also seen the new religions and new spiritualities as mirrors of deficiencies of the church. In the Lausanne group on new spiritualities, we have talked about them as the unpaid bills of the church. Furthermore, I have had to change my way of meeting people within the new spirituality milieus. What I have learned over the years is the need to move from a defensive or even hostile attitude towards New Agers and neo-spiritual seekers and practitioners to dialogue and, most of all, presence in their milieu. If the gospel should be heard, and the Christian Fellowship be enculturated. In 1995, I started in a new ministry in the new spirituality milieus under the name In the Master's Light. This ministry began as spiritual meetings in premises known to New Agers and in a form familiar to them, but unmistakably Christian. The meetings has an invocation on Jesus, periods of meditation, a sharing of the Word of God, a prophetic message called an inspiration, prayer for the healing of the world, and praying with people for the healing of their hearts. Our most effective ministry is being present at holistic fairs, body, mind, spirit festivals, and other grassroots events. It's a booth ministry, and we invite people to receive a blessing or a healing of the heart, which means that we pray the love of God revealed in Jesus into their life. We also pray with people for other concerns. Over the years, we have experienced that even many of our co-expositioners ask for our ministry. At the largest fair, the Body, Mind, Spirit Fair in February in Copenhagen, this year we prayed with more than 450 guests and exhibitioners. And at the Mystical Fair at Halloween, we prayed with 550 persons and had more than 100 very deep counseling talks within our booth. We also have workshops and liturgical services at the fairs. We try to involve people afterwards in different kinds of meetings, such as services praying for the healing of the earth and of humankind. We also try to engage people in prayer triangles, and we arrange different introduction courses to Christian spirituality and discipleship. If we will meet the new spiritualities people, we'll have to define and find common concerns with them, for example, in the field of environmental situation of the planet. And we have to find points of contact in their beliefs and practices, as Paul did in Athens. As people make more or less their own personal faith construction of the most diverse elements from differing spiritual traditions, it's very easy also to find Christian components. If we don't judge these syncretistic and eclectic faith constructions, but instead ask for the intentions and hopes behind them, rejoicing in the common elements and asking for their meaning in the other person's faith construction, and then telling of their meaning in our life with Jesus, these elements will be bridgeheads for the gospel into the life of the people we get as our friends. To listen is the only way also to be allowed to share our experiences of God and the new life in Jesus Christ. We'll have to present the gospel in a learning by doing mode, instead of overburdening people with a full package of Christian doctrine and ethics. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't learn doctrines and learn to live after the will of God. Of course not. But step by step, we'll have to revitalize Christian worship and spirituality, and having the new spirituality people help us recognizing our forgotten treasures, for example, the power of prayer, Christian meditation, the liturgical heritage and the undivided church, retreats and communities, spiritual counseling, pilgrimage. All this is somehow present, at least in the longing among the practices of New Ages. But most of all, we'll have to be disciples of Jesus who really are an authentic part of the milieus in which we share the gospel. Show it, don't tell it. We have to be a Christian fellowship. We have to be a church, a body of Christ in the milieu, and we have to speak the language of the milieu. And then sometimes we really get surprised and find that practices that we have condemned as demonic, that they may become mediators for the gospel. This happened to me, believe it or not, with the tarot cards, in such a way that even tarot readers and tarot masters have found a new insight from the gospel through the ministry of In the Master's Light. For example, at one fair, some tarot readers and practitioners came to me and asked if I could conduct a Bible study with them in order so that they could understand what they were doing. And we had 4 full Saturdays meditating on the Bible and of the biblical and Christian imagery in the trump cards of the tarot. And now tarot readers at the fairs send people to our booths because that's where the readings is showing people.
I'm just going to make some concluding remarks as we come towards the end of our time. Really, in a sense, some of the lessons we're learning in this kind of ministry that I think have wider implications. We were listening to Victor Howe talking earlier about Muslims having dreams, and this has been very common in that kind of world or in India. Well, the reality is, with people's increasing openness to spirituality in white Western communities, we are increasingly finding people turning up who said, I had a dream last night in which Jesus came to me and I need to talk to someone about it. And they're turning up on the doors of churches, and the churches don't always know what to do with them. So you have now been warned. When they come to you, be ready to tell them about what they have been experiencing. We have also been finding that actually what attracts people to faith is often the vision for society and its transformation. They're actually not, as they come to you asking questions often about sin, they don't understand that kind of concept. How to get them to explore it, though, is often by saying about the world and the vision for the world that we live in, and the society that they know needs transforming, and then admitting their own part in the failures and the weakness that means society is the way it is. And so that vision for Christ transforming people's lives is often the key to it. Indeed, I think in many ways, you could see here a vision for a re-evangelization of Europe that actually perhaps owes a lot to the first evangelization of Europe. Where I come from in Britain, we're very privileged to have a tradition of the Celtic Church. The whole reason the Celtic Church existed is because monks who'd been trained in France went to places like Ireland and Scotland, and they found ways of sharing the faith with those people that they discovered that resonated with their culture, that they were open to the belief in God's spiritual power at work to transform people's lives, and they converted that culture, indeed, almost, if you like, converted the very land through the holy wells and the pilgrimage places to become a Christian place. And I think we're going to have to do something similar again. But I think this openness to spirituality provides a real opportunity to do this. It's not the only game in town. There are plenty of other ways God is calling us to share faith. But I think this is an important opening. And my encouragement is for everyone to use that opening with people they encounter. So listen to their spiritual experiences and turn them into the gateway to share the gospel message in Europe today. Thank you.